down to brass tacks. Hello?
Hi, good morning, Mr. Ellie.
Yes, good morning.
Like, oh, let's talk about Nelson. Like, move Nelson and put her a bedroom, man. That's it. By the 1st of August. Mr. Ellis?
Yes, ma'am.
Do you believe that Leah should be done with?
Well, ideally, I don't want to see the collapse of Leah. But if it must be done away with, then there's got to be a replacement that works more efficiently. We have more buy-in to, and that, as has been suggested, I think today in the newspaper by the head of the Private Sector Association, that presents us with a good combination of public and private sector interests. If we really consider Leah to be so important to the region as a whole, then we should have an airline that ideally people across the Caribbean should be able to buy into and see it working effectively, efficiently, and in a way that we are able to move more freely across the region. As it stands right now, Leah has been seriously hobbled by the fact that it costs so much to travel from one island to the next. It does not make sense.
So you believe that getting a new airline, that will change things?
Well, it depends upon the structure, the extent to which you've been able to learn from the mistakes over the years. Part of the problem with Leah may well be that it's got so much government involvement. And across the region, we have recognized that many agencies and departments and stuff that have government involvement have real problems, because the first order of business for some politicians is to look for the people that support them to staff the place. And sometimes a lot of those people, you've seen it here with statutory corporations, they become untouchable, you know. Sometimes the person is trying to do the best possible job. They're not untouchable, but once they look at the figures and they say, but you know, we got too much staff. We can't handle so many people in this organization. The politician says, oh no, you can't touch them because these are my votes. So the place will never be allowed to run efficiently.
Okay. But I believe that they should work with Leah and it just need working on and change it up. Because if someone else take over now, Mr. Ellis.
Change it up how? How would you change it?
Get a new, you know, a new plane or whatever. I wonder, right, which island the flight base will be placed in? You know, there'll be a lot of tug of war.
I don't know how much tug of war there can be. I mean, to be a hub, you got to be able to create these connections, and you know, the logistics matter. So there are not many countries that can really function in that particular way. I certainly hope that coming out of all the high-level discussions, because, you know, it is the heads of government who are now discussing this, and coming out of all of this, that we will get something meaningful. You will notice that the Prime Minister of Antigua and Barbuda is his inclination. He's out in the lead, and he likes to go public with a lot of these things very early, whereas other prime ministers feel that the way to deal with it is behind the scenes first, and sort things out there, and then come to the public. Gaston Brown has a different kind of strategy, and it's going to be interesting to see what the response is from Barbados in particular, and the other Caribbean, CARICOM countries,
so
the
what
idea
you think,
that he's loaded.
So what do you think, guys, Mr. Brown out front, because he wants to stay over in Antigua? What do you think he out front?
But he said so.
He
has not hidden the fact that he wants to see Antigua as a headquarters for Leah. He says, I saw the letter that he wrote to the others. Mm-hmm. In which he says that Antigua doesn't get anything much out of the CARICOM experience except Leah. That's what he said.
I know that'd be tug of war boat there here, Mr. Ellis. Anyhow, you have a good day here.
Well, thanks for calling.
All right, bye-bye.
Down to brass tacks. Hello?
Hello, good morning.
Hello.
Hi, good morning, Mr. Ellis.
Morning.
I am a frequent listener, very rare caller. I just wanted to make a couple brief contributions, if you'd allow me.
Sure.
The first contribution is regarding your opening statements about the Google settings. So
yes.
I looked at it and I realized, okay, yes, we have this COVID notification system in. Now, I distinctly remember listening to the news on both this station and other stations, as well as reading online, that this is a system that was being rolled out worldwide to help with the COVID-19 fight. And I was not surprised when I saw it there because I knew, okay, this is probably going to come in one of the updates. But like many other Android users, I have my updates set to run automatically, and I'm not really in the practice of reading the new permissions that are needed for the various apps to be installed. I would simply submit to most of the listeners, if you're that uncomfortable with these things happening, you know, read the permissions when you're installing the apps. Install the apps manually so you'll see what is actually, what the apps are actually being allowed to do. That's not to say that communication was atrocious. I will admit that it was. But at the end of the day, we as users still have some responsibility for what we allow to be put on our phones. That's the first point.
Okay.
Right. Second point, one of your customers, sorry, one of your callers called in with reference to paying a bill at the Light and Power. I starkly disagree. This is 2020. I am one of those who, as much as possible, I refuse to walk with any cash. Any payments that can be done online, I will do them online. It saves me having to spend time and gas or bus fare, whatever you call it, to go to these locations and pay. I don't even like to go to that, to the other institutions which facilitate making many bill payments in one location. I prefer to sit in the comfort of my home, log on to my bank account, and make my payments online.
Do you know anyone who is reluctant to do that?
Who is reluctant to?
To stay at home and make online payments.
Yeah, actually, I know many people who are reluctant because they don't understand how the banking system works. They don't understand how online payments work.
Right.
So, as a result,
they're suspicious too. There are a lot of people who feel that you're vulnerable to hackers and that sort of thing too.
Yes, but walking down the road with cash, I'm vulnerable to thieves. If someone was to mug me and take my cash, I mean, the chances of me getting back my cash are slim to none.
You've spoken to anybody and told them that?
Pardon me?
You told anyone that?
I have, but...
And what did they say to it?
They still said, well, I still prefer to pay because I know when I pay and I get my receipt, I know this is paid. They don't realize that you get receipts when you make online payments. And the tracking system is actually much better. But I am a young person. I'm only 31. Mm-hmm. So many people will say, man, this young boy, you know we're getting on. So I just leave it as that, and I go on. I mean, it's something as simple as using your ATM card to make a payment. You're levied a certain amount. If you have a Visa debit card, for example, and you make the same payment, there are no fees that are levied to your account. So many people still don't understand how that works, but it is one of those things. So one other very brief contribution regarding this entire Nelson story, and going to be very brief with this. Now, we have a lot to learn in terms of the history, and the main issue with the statue of Lord Nelson being in National Heroes Square, to me it seems like we're celebrating someone who would have stood contrary to what we're supposed to be celebrating in National Heroes Square. And that is part of the reason why I believe that he should be moved from there. If you want to have him placed somewhere else where you can show the history, that is fine. But remember, And this is very important. Everyone who says that we need to move on and we need to move on with our lives, this history, it is so long ago. Remember what is happening right now in Germany, in Europe, especially when it comes to the Holocaust and the survivors of the Holocaust. Nobody's telling them to move on, and very rightly so. They have to remember their history. They have to make sure that the story is told and that it can never happen again.
Now that's your perspective.
Yeah, definitely. People may disagree, and that's their prerogative, but thank you very much for allowing me this time. And in closing, the comment I should have started with, I want to wish Dennis Johnson a very speedy recovery. He is my favorite moderator. He's one of the reasons I started listening to Brass Tacks, and I always enjoy listening to him. The other moderators are quite good as well, but I don't know. Dennis Johnson just reaches out.
Okay. Thank you very much for calling. Down to Brass Tacks.
And to you as well today, Mr. Ellis. A blessed day to you, sir.
Yes, sir.
And to the station and the country in general, you know, we always need to have these blessings on us. Can't do without it. As much as those who might think that they don't believe in God and all of that, you know, people say things like that because they want to continue in their ways. So, but that would not distract those of us who believe that there is. Mr. Ellis, I want to make a few observations. I'm not going to speak about the Auditor General report now because that would be a little bit long, because there are a few things in there that I would like to draw to your attention, but I'm not going to do that now. I want to say first, I want to say I thank the government for what they have done as far as the certificate of character is concerned, because my grandson put in an application, and in less than 3 days' time, he had back the answer. But he paid for the certificate online, of course, and he had back the message that it was okay. And I think that was a matter of 3 days or thereabout. And I thought that was very outstanding, rather than having to wait 2 or 3 weeks and wait in line and all that. So there's progress
in that area.
Oh, yeah, tremendous. I've told you already, and people, I'm a Barbadian. Regardless of which government is in office, it's my government. And we want the best. And I believe that when things are done, and we ought to be able to compliment and say thanks for those things. And when they're not, say that. There are those who would want to cut throats when they are critical of things that are happening. You know, remember, and I say it to people, Jesus, our Savior, was on earth, and he had more criticism than he had praise. That's why they crucified him. So we must understand these things. That's the first thing I want to say. Pardon?
Yes.
Yeah. The next thing I want to take note of, Mr. Ellis, I am very concerned about what I'm hearing about the banks pressuring or being not being fair to our credit union movement. I'm concerned about this, very concerned. In that we know that the banks over the years have not only done a lot, they did good things too by lending money and all that, but look and see the kind of interest that they charged us, and then they were ready to sell our properties and all of that. Because that system was set up strictly not really to help us as such, but the greater benefit are the other way around. And I'm concerned about that. And I would like our government really to look at this thing in a very serious way, because if they are trying to pressure our credit union where the masses are putting their money because there are greater benefits that they are seeing, and not only that, we are getting dividends and we are getting the kind of returns and as far as the interest is concerned, it's greater. And when banks are going to be doing things like this to our unit. Mr. Ellis, our nation is not only predominantly... No.
And you know, in all this discussion that we are having in Barbados at the moment, the credit union movement has been a success, a significant success. From my own observation, it appears as though the credit union movement has played a key role in helping Barbadians to own a home. My question is, what about the next frontier of development when it comes to what we call economic enfranchisement? What is the track record of the credit union movement in that regard? And the question is, what is holding it back when it comes to being able to make more of a contribution in that area? Because you, in my judgment, it is the most significant question confronting us right now. I listen to discussions in the United States, and I see that there is one point of view that the vast gap between whites and blacks when it comes to home ownership has played a pivotal role in keeping black people where they are in that society. In ours, we have quite a lot of home ownership in this country, but when it comes to the development of business, because this is where a lot of the criticism is right now, how can the credit union, I mean, we brag and boast about it so much, but my question therefore is, why is it that it appears as though, notwithstanding its growth, we have not been able to see more of a contribution in that area? What do you think?
My view is that, you know, first of all, the laws have got to be put in place for that, because, and you know, that the laws does not permit the credit unions to do things like what the bank does as far as business deposits and things of that sort. And therefore, that is something that our government has to put in place as far as the laws are concerned.
But what about the, I mean, through the loans that it makes to the people who are its members?
Mr. Ellis, I don't like to stress certain things. I've been dealing with the credit union for some years now, and I have been ably assisted by them in business operations. I have been, and the thing that they do, you pay back your loans on the reducing balance. If the bank lend you $10,000, you're going to pay interest on that $10,000 from number day one to
number. Yeah, but if that's an advantage, so if that's an advantage, seriously, if that is an advantage, then we have to ask, what are the factors inhibiting the credit union movement from making more of a contribution in business development?
The other thing is, it has a lot to do with those of us who have been educated at our universities, and there are where a lot of us are kind of fragmented rather than, let's say, myself and two or three of us going to the credit union and say, well, I have my deposit, so on, so on, so on, so on. And you present your business model to them, and we work together as far as that aspect of it is concerned. And a lot of us go to university, and then all we do, we go to university expecting to go and work for somebody else. And we need, look, this country need to have a greater understanding of what investment are all about. I'm about to try to go into a project myself. And one of the things that I do, because then I find that a lot of us would wait back and say, man, look, you go ahead and I'll see how you do first and then I'll come after. This is what we do. I've had a situation like that where people will sit back and wait until you go out there and put your investment. And when they see then how it is thriving, then they say, well, look, come, I'm ready now. And this is a problem that we have, because then investment calls for risk. And as long as you have a business attitude about your business and what you're doing, then there's no need for anybody to be afraid of what we are doing. And I'm looking forward, and I want to see that our government give our credit union a license to open its own bank. Because in here it is, when the credit union take our funds and they have to go and distribute it and deposit it with them, with the other people, look and see what's happening. You can imagine a bank giving you next to nothing on what you have, a 0.25. But for God's sakes, Mr. Ellis. I mean, this is absolutely ridiculous. And then they're going to charge you over 10, 12% if you have to go to them. Where are we going? When are we going to be really serious? And I'll tell you this, I'm concerned about the system. And the system has been set up from the initial stages to stymie us. They see us as hew of the wood and draws of water. This is how the system had seen us ever since. I've been listening to CNN the other day. You know what I heard a reporter say? He said, America has 13% black people, and they have only 2.5% of the wealth. You can imagine that. 2.5% and have a 13%.
Yeah, but you really, if you check the world, you know, you will see that the people of darker skin have had more challenges across the globe than those of lighter skin.
Is that it?
And, I mean, only today I was listening to a piece coming out in which they were focusing on the Arab world. And even there, black people will tell you that it is harder to get through than if you are a light-skinned person or a white person. This is global. The notion that Black Lives Matter is not peculiar to the United States. If you look at the structure of Barbados today, you will also hear these complaints coming at you all the time. You get them more during election periods, and every political party comes and gives the impression that it is capable of changing the construct. But in next to no time, when you look at it, you start to realize, but wait, the more things change, the more they remain the same.
Because, Ms. Ellis, remember this, that the system has been set up by the capitalists from the beginning to do this to us.
But what can we do for ourselves? It is one thing to say what they have done to us.
I'll tell you though, what we can do for
ourselves. Apart from cutting down each other all the time. You know, even in these debates that you're having, you know, we as black people get pretty nasty to each other when we're ready. You know that.
That is right.
All because, you know, you got all these inflamed passions about this and that. And you end up fighting among ourselves. That's how we are.
But let me say this to you.
Divide and rule.
Mr. Ellis, listen, don't make the mistake to think that the other races don't have it dinged
down. Well, I can only speak about what we experience. At least there are others who are able to do their thing and do it sometimes in secret. One day we will wake up, for instance. If you look at Barbados and how it is structured right now, there's a third force in Barbadian society that is quietly acquiring land, acquiring wealth, doing its thing, all right? And all the eyes are on other people. We need to have a holistic approach to this, you know, in my judgment. You know, this thing about just getting all hysterical about this and about that, that is not going to solve the problem for us. We got to have a holistic focus on it. The government of today, the Motley administration, came to office with a lot of complaints about how contracts were being given to certain people and how wrong it was. And you have to hold their feet to the fire and ask the question, and what are you doing that is so different today?
What has changed?
Who are the people on the boards? You know, let's look at these things. When we see who you have placed on the boards, explain that to us. All right? Yes. Justify what you have done and tell us why you have done it that way. How much progress are we seeing in the areas where you say small business must thrive? We've given grants. We've given this. We've given that. Okay. With what success? These things, these questions have to be asked. Because if you don't ask them right now and get answers to them, fool not yourself. People can become restless. If you don't tackle these issues, one day they blow up. And you want to avoid that. So that is why we need to be adjusting this thing as we go along. Not by giving us a placebo, but really discussing real change in a country that is resistant to that kind of change. Highly resistant. All right? Because let me make one more observation on it. Is this. Over the years, I have noticed that Barbados has been afraid as a country to tackle these issues because there's always the fear that it can get out of hand. You don't know where it will take you. Don't forget, I always remind people who talk about these matters that in the 1970s, the Public Order Act was introduced by whom? The right excellent Earl Walton Barrow. All right? To do what? To stave off the kind of unrest that we were seeing in parts of America and in Jamaica and stuff, with Walter Rodney and don't forget, Stokely Carmichael come to Barbados, but he wasn't to speak, all right? Because there has been this concern and this fear that it can get out of hand, it can take us where we don't want to go. And that's why I think it's absolutely essential that we come to terms with what the structure and the need to bring about change. There are a lot of people out there who are hungry to become business people. They've been well educated. And they ask the question, but why can't I get more of this? Why do I have to fight against these odds? And to find myself in a situation where, when I look at what is happening, some people here are able to get whatever they want. And I can't get any of it because they're being protected. The market has changed. Why should the market forces not be allowed to work? These are the questions that people are asking. And I think we got to recognize that you can't run away from these things anymore.
Now, we have people in Barbados who are very critical when they hear Mr. Nasser come on the radio and have to speak. Ms. Ellis, I'm saying to you, person who have never yet conducted or even thought of going into a business or had any business dealing would be critical of him because then they don't know better because they're speaking out of ignorance. But when you have been a business person and you have gone through the hornpipe, I'm telling you, because of the system that has been set up to blunt us, I'm telling you, unless you are able to talk to a person personally to tell you what they have experienced in their business, you may not know or understand. But when you have gone through it and have experienced and see how it has been set up to destroy you and stop you from progressing.
There are two sides to that.
Listen to me now. There are two sides to us, but they're not two sides to the others.
There are two sides. Because I have heard many of the people over the years who have discussed this issue cast and characterize black business people as individuals who often take the money from within the company and lick it out on cars and houses and women and that sort of thing. That's how it's been characterized among black people who are talking about others who have been, you know, running businesses in this country. So, you know, often we are our own worst enemies. You recognize that, huh?
Can be.
All right. So, for me, the conversation has to be one, recognizing what are the obstacles to change, and then asking the question, what can be done to address those issues? And also recognize this. There are successful black people in the country, but many times they won't let you know that they feel a sense of success, because they also feel that the minute that you know that they are successful,
they'll be targeted.
Yes. And targeted by whom? By their own people. That's what they tell you. So that is all part of the mix of issues that we must confront. Now, in conversations with people, what you find is that we are different individuals, and some people would focus only on one narrow aspect of it and feel comfortable with it. They feel uncomfortable when you cast the net wider, because they feel that that dilutes the main point that they want to make. But whether we like it or not, it is not. It is complex. We have a wide range of issues here. You come here often and you talk the politics. But people in Barbados, many people feel that the politicians are the ones who aid and abet in keeping the system as it is.
Mm-hmm. Ms. Ellis, I'll tell you something that has people very concerned, because when you look and see how our government has been able to write off taxpayers when we go and we pay our VAT and so on, and we see those people who collect that money don't pay, and then they wait and
but
wait.
How many of them? How many of them happen to be small business
but
people?
But there's some people. They're not small people. Small people pay their money.
Well, I don't know. You know,
there's nobody who is anxious to pay taxes faster than the poor people.
Listen. That's true in a sense, but I would have to see those files to be able to just follow your argument that it is only the rich and powerful who are allowed to get away with that. Because the truth is that in listening to public debate on issues, many times the people who are smaller individuals are as guilty of doing some of this stuff. And when you look at the cumulative effect, it can be quite a lot of money, you know. So, I mean, I am not in a position, because I don't know, you know, the facts behind all of that, to say, oh, it is only the big ups who do this. It's a combination of people. And trust me, what I've seen in the country over the years suggests that whether you're dealing with the big people or the small people, you've got to keep your eyes open. I've talked already about how small people are taken advantage of by other small players and stuff, can't get anything done. And then they come with all sorts of excuses and that sort of thing. So, you know, all of that needs to be addressed if we are to make a positive change in this environment. Okay? But a pleasure talking with you. Down to brass tacks. Look, I want the authorities to do something about that. The lighting out there by that Jersey barrier in Welch's. This is dangerous. I mean, you know how easy it is for somebody to slam into that at night. Something has to be done. This has been left like this for so long. I say no more than that. I hope that the authorities will look really seriously at it. Because if you're going north, you can find yourself in a situation where it is difficult to recognize that that Jersey barrier is there as you are about to enter the lane, one of the two lanes to go north. This is Down to Brass Stats. Hello?
You mentioned that I can do a community service and buy some cat eyes as soon as possible and attach them. I think that's a community-spirited thing. It's possible. If I could get my hands on some cat eyes, I can probably do that. I'm not familiar with the barrier, but I don't live in that part of the world. But if there's something that could be done like that, why not? I mean, surely little small things like this, a constituency representative should be on the ball and deal with. I mean, it's not a big deal. A light is not a problem. And I 100% support you. I'm not familiar with the area, but it sounds like something a constituency representative should be very well aware of. I'm responding kind. So, there you go. You have your particular instructions from David Ellis. And you're my favorite moderator, by the way. Not Dennis Johnson. I just wanted to tell you that in person. And I'm only 40 years old. So I can't see me go back all these years. But in all that time, I have never, ever witnessed what I witnessed over the weekend. Where you had on social media a number of people thanking a permanent secretary for the work that was done in allowing the passengers to leave, not the passengers, the workers to leave the boats and pass through the airport and return to Mexico. Human service. I mean, it was fantastic that all of this was done. No minister was involved. I have never in my entire life seen something so dramatic. And there was no minister there to take any credit for it. And it suggests, surely to me, that we have executives in positions that are already paid by taxpayers to do work that you never hear about. Permanent secretaries are there for a reason, and they are paid. I have never thought it was necessary to have both a permanent secretary and an executive minister. But there we have it. We still have them these days. And here it is that we have a permanent secretary doing all of that work and getting all of the praise. I am so glad for this person. I'm not sure if it's a male or female, but whoever it is, I am so glad that he or she got all of the credit. All. No minister was in there. Never happened in my life before. So I had to raise that there. And having said that, leading into the LEAT thing, I think you should recognize that permanent secretaries, yes, are government. Government are the people that taxpayers, these people are paid to do a job. Policy comes from the private sector. You see, political parties are not government, you know. They are private entities. That's what they are. So when you have problems with LEAT and various little and other institutions, whether they are SOEs, which means state-owned enterprises, or, you know, people that accept transfers, the problem is not really so much the officers that work. The problems invariably arise from the private sector, which is a political party. So if it is that you can find a way to separate their interests from the interests of those who actually work in the institutions and the interests of those who those institutions serve, well, then we could be going forward. But we can't be blaming those issues as government. They're not government issues. They're private sector issues because the party is a private sector. We have a central bank of the OECS that has been working, 30, 35 years without problems, no real issues. And that is not really considered to be a private sector body. It works. And it works in the end. And Barbados could very well sign up, because they have proven themselves over time to perform the role, the primary role, which I understand to be the preservation of the American US dollar peg. They've done it successfully for all these years without big cause for concern and news items and stuff. And to my mind, LEAT should be treated the same way. You know, I do not think this whole process of leave it up to the private sector to fix. Oh, we got a problem, private sector will fix it. We got the airport needs to be done, private sector will fix it. We got LEAT, that is nonsense. Some issues need to be run and handled properly by professionals who do not have the bottom line.
Who's been running LIAT most of these years?
You know, the truth is, again, you have the parties getting involved. All right? Now, there is, you know, truth be told, whatever happens with the Caribbean Development Bank, whatever happens with the OECS Central Bank, however they operate, make LIAT operate the same way too. And not with no big law, big salaries neither. Make them operate the same way too. Whatever structure they have, they have proven that this thing can work. I do not see any big involvement of political parties with either of the two of them, because I think they know their place when they go to deal with these kind of institutions. They know their place. So LIAT seems to be separately operated, separately designed. Gonzalez is quite right. It is not a profit-making entity. It is a responsibility that goes well beyond the profit, the bottom line. The Central Bank of Barbados doesn't really earn a profit. It probably makes enough money this year to pay for any losses from the previous year, but it's not there to generate a profit. LIAT cannot be seen in the same way. It is too valuable. It's too valuable of a resource. It's a utility-level type of service that needs to be maintained at all costs. And you put that in the hands of the private sector, and I'm going to tell you, to be honest with you, there ain't a private sector person in Barbados that would take that on. It's like CBC. If I can't say it in public, because I want to sell CBC. But there ain't a private sector with any brain will come and take on LIAT, having had the problems with the taxation. We have had private sector airlines through the Caribbean. I think KSHEV has even got involved with something. And they all closed within a year or two.
Because they had LIAT fighting against them as well.
Well, yeah, LIAT, of course. But
you may recall that.
Yeah, but I mean, the prices that they were offering were competitive prices, and then they're slapping on taxes left, right, and center, which is making it very prohibitive for most people to travel. But at the end of the day, the LIAT was the competition, yes, but then, of course, the government policy when it came to, you know, the rights of the airlines to use a particular airports, and that has to be considered as well, too. So if it continues as a government thing, and you take the parties out of it, because parties don't get involved again, parties do not get involved with the OECS Central Bank. They don't. Parties don't get involved with the Caribbean Development Bank. They don't. But so let's keep those out of LIAT in the same way. Keep it as a government entity with professionals who damn well know what they're doing. You may have a board. I don't even know what you need a board for.
What has gone wrong over the years, therefore?
No. The taxation policy is one thing, and because the prices were really too high. A question of perhaps administrative costs, really sky high. And, you know, that guy spoke about all, Patterson spoke about all those pilots and other people who will be out of work. That is not something that would be acceptable in any event. So there's no question that it's not going to be on the chopping block for very long, because the responsibility has to be maintained. Governments will have to find a way to put money back in there and make sure that the administrative costs are dropped, and somehow find a way to make sure the taxation is also not prohibitive, so people will be encouraged to travel, and in so doing, help the trade and commerce and all this fancy stuff and tourism and stuff throughout the region. It is a utility service, and it has to operate that way. I am not even so sure if Trinidad Airlines, what do they call it again, or Caribbean Airlines, would be prepared to take it on, because they took over Air Jamaica, but they're probably more involved with extra-regional travel more so than intra-regional travel. And those little air prop planes are a different kind of breed as opposed to, when compared to the jets. But as a separate entity, LIAT, you know, just keep the politicians out of it, and it will work.
Okay.
I mean, as I've said, you see that happen with the OECS Central Bank, you see it happen with the Caribbean Development Bank. What other agencies that are through the region? Maybe one or two others. The politicians are just not involved.
All right. Thank you very much. This is Down to Brass Tacks. This person says that the Cut Rock, going from Hothersill Turning to Waterford Bottom. He says that they are the same color as the road. It's very dangerous at night. They need some reflectors there as well. I think he's talking about the Jersey barriers there. He says it Cut Rock, going from Hothersill Turning to Waterford Bottom. Down to Brass Tacks. Hello? You're on the air. Speak. You're listening.
Yes. Good morning.
Yes. Good morning.
Good morning, David. How are you?
I'm well. It's 11:47.
Yeah, I heard Ms. Undecided say that we needed to look for Barbadian to replace the Nelson statue. I think that the person, in my opinion, who is already a national hero. He's the only living national hero from humble beginnings. He dominated the sport, which is the favorite sport of all Caribbean people and Barbadian people. A man of utmost humility and will be accepted by all.
So you moved the statue of Sir Garfield Sobers from Kensington Oval to Bridgetown?
Yes, it needs to be moved from there and used as a symbol of national pride and excellence for future generations.
Okay.
There are many other great cricketers that could adorn Kensington. But I think if you're looking for a national hero that would be acceptable to most Barbadians, regardless of race, politics, and all that, I think Sir Garfield Sobers is by far the clearest choice, because it is Heroes Square. And we will want a hero there. And we will want a hero that transcends.
I really am fascinated by all of this talk about Heroes Square, because let me tell you something. I pass this square on a regular basis. And I look at what has been happening in Bridgetown. I don't know if you guys realize the extent to which parts of Bridgetown are really overrun by vagrants and look bad. I want somebody to go and take a photograph of how Ninja Man got the side of the Treasury Building. If you think it was bad before, it has never been as bad as I've seen it passing there. I look at with interest at the government's plan to create the Clement Payne Park, or whatever they may call it. And when I see what is happening with the way that Bridgetown is kept, and the increase in the number of vagrants in Bridgetown, I mean, amazing. We spent a lot of time talking about that aspect of it, the Nelson aspect of it, and so you can. But there are other elements to this whole question of how we feel about ourselves when we go through Bridgetown. I think so.
But David, in all fairness, Ninja Man being there and the other vagrants, the whole of the city could be cleaned up, and the whole of the island could be cleaned up.
But there's no commitment to that. Our commitment is to creating monuments. Our commitment is to erecting this, erecting that. But how do we maintain it? Bridgetown is not being... It doesn't come across to me as though we are really serious about that.
David, it is not a question of any part of the country could be cleaned up. That is a question for the authorities to enforce rules. The whole problem with us is not a question of rules and regulations. It has been a question, really, of implementation and not allowing stupid politics to get in the way of what should be really national pride and understanding. But in the terms, I want to tap back, because the reason that I think that Sagari would be accepted by everybody, he qualifies as a national hero already. He's the story of colonialism and independence all bound up in one. And I think it would be a fitting tribute to him and for what he stands for.
We didn't move that statue from up there by Life of Barbados Roundabout before? That's where it was originally.
But you see, when you're going through a transition like we are going through now, we have to be careful not to inflame people.
So he didn't score his runs and take his wickets at Kensington Oval?
Yes, but of course he did that in Australia too. He did it in India. He did it in Jamaica.
But we can't send him to Australia or India. We got to deal with
that's
it.
That's what I mean.
Kensington Oval.
What I'm trying to say. He's a worldwide sporting icon recognized, and I say that I think that when Mr. Andesides said that he should look for a Barbadian of some statue to put there, I just say that Garfield Sobers, Sagari, perhaps qualifies and accepted by all. That's what I'm looking at.
You are entitled to your view and your suggestion. I just I know that there are other people who would feel quite comfortable with it being, the statue being where it is at the moment. But your argument is that all the heroes should be in Hero Square. So if you go by that yardstick, then we should be taking the Busser statue, the Emancipation statue, from Haggard Hall and put it in town too. You know, that's where you would be going with all of them. This is Down to Brass Tacks.